Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we start with comic absurdity, that's Obamacare. Then we move to scary absurdity, that's the New York Police Department. And we end with global calamity, as pointed out by Derek Jensen. That's something for everybody, so I hope you'll stay tuned. This will be one of those shows where we compare great things with small, as the saying goes. We had one like this back in mid-June. In that show, first I complained about deceptive labeling at the supermarket. And then Noam Chomsky complained about our corporate leader's mad rush to destroy the Earth's ecosystem and kill everything alive through global warming for the sake of short-term profit. Well, between us, I guess Noam and I pretty much covered all the bases. And this week, too, we'll hear a fine speech by the radical environmentalist Derek Jensen. Jensen points to Western civilization's mad rush to destroy the Earth's ecosystem, and he explores the question of when we have the duty to break the law and take direct action. Good question. But let's work our way up to that. Start off with some minor outrages, and gradually work our way up to global extinction. Let's start with Obamacare. We've now had several weeks of Republican politicians and Democratic politicians grandstanding about the snafu rollout of the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. I feel like I'm watching a Punch and Judy show, and it's about as convincing. Here's what neither side is saying, and our corporate-controlled media are not saying either. Obamacare is at best a cheat and a fraud. It's a cumbrous, expensive, and oppressive program that will do nothing to lower our country's obscene healthcare costs. It fails to ensure that every American will receive the medical care he or she needs. It is designed mainly to increase insurance companies' profits. The whole system was designed by the Heritage Foundation. This is a well-funded, ultra-right-wing think tank. This system was designed from the start to be a big business-friendly alternative to the real healthcare reform that President Bill Clinton was pretending to favor. What they call Obamacare was first implemented at the state level in Massachusetts by a Republican legislature under conservative Republican Governor Mitt Romney. How much more do you need to know? That's what Obamacare is. It's a right-wing, big business crock of fertilizer. Now the Republicans are pretending that it is socialism. They think that's an insult. And the Democrats are pretending that Obamacare is the New Deal reborn. America deserves much better than this. At the very least, we deserve a low-cost, single-payer system like every other first-world country has, except us. Obamacare is a fraud and a cheat, and the recent tut-tutting about its computer glitches misses the point. And of course, everybody running the show wants us to miss the point. Now that I've got that off my chest, here's a fun article I found in SatireWire.com. It takes a kinder, gentler, more comic approach to Obamacare. So let's have a listen. It's titled, From Obamacare to Abolition: Landmark Law Rollout Failures. Condensed and edited for radio by yours truly. Americans are furious over the inept rollout of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. But landmark legislation has a history of early backfires. For example, 1863, Emancipation Proclamation, otherwise known as Abolition. Republican President Lincoln's executive order freed an estimated 3.1 million slaves in the Confederacy. Lincoln's Democratic opponents called this the biggest jobs-killing government program of all time. Thanks to printing glitches, the proclamation freed Southern slaves, but required free Northern blacks to choose a master within 6 months or pay a fine. Originally, the law stated that those laboring less than 30 hours a week were considered part-time slaves, and therefore were eligible only for part-time freedom. This prompted hundreds of plantation owners to reduce slave work hours to avoid having to provide full-time freedom. In any case, plantations owning 50 or fewer slaves were exempt for the first year. Similar to Obamacare, not everyone eligible for abolition was able to obtain it. White House spokesperson Cathcart Theophilus blamed the Confederacy, but he later admitted the administration's early test runs had succeeded in emancipating only a horse and a couple of chickens. Unfriendly news outlets like the New York Sun intentionally muddied the waters. The Sun reported that Lincoln was not offering to free the slaves, but was offering free slaves. The president quickly quashed the rumor. But doing so lost Lincoln the support of New Englanders, a hardy and cheapskate people. New Englanders detested slavery, but they hated missing out on a deal even more. Okay, moving on. Another creaky rollout was the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act, otherwise known as Benjamin Harris Socialism. The Sherman Antitrust Act was signed by Republican President Benjamin Harrison. It was the first U.S. law to take on big business by banning anti-competitive practices and banning cartels and monopolies. A grassroots group of everyday mining tycoons and railroad magnates immediately tried to repeal the law. They said the law would be hardest on the working poor. They shot as many as 200 workers a day to prove it. President Harrison's Democratic opponents called the act the biggest jobs-killing government program of all time. Like Obamacare, it was 10 years before the Sherman Antitrust Act was actually enforced. But eventually it was. And this is why companies like Microsoft, Comcast, Google, and J.P. Morgan Chase do not exist today. And who could forget the initial troubles with the 1906 Federal Meat Inspection Act, otherwise known as Teddy Roosevelt Vegetarianism? The Federal Meat Inspection Act, signed by Republican President Teddy Roosevelt, ensured that animals were slaughtered and processed under sanitary conditions. It also required meat to be correctly labeled. Democratic opponents called it the biggest disgusting jobs-killing government program of all time. The act provoked riots, as the public feared the law would drive up meat prices. The protests ceased after producers assured the public that they had not been selling genuine meat since 1861. And, of course, there were also rollout problems with the 1935 Social Security Act, otherwise known as FDR Fair. The Social Security Act provided a safety net for older and unemployed Americans. It was signed during the Great Depression by Democrat Franklin D. Roosevelt. Republicans blasted it, saying that nobody actually has a job, but if they did, this would be the biggest job-killing government program of all time. Okay, so chin up, President Obama. Initial glitches happen all the time with landmark legislation. Here's another dispatch on the same theme, and that theme is, you may believe in democracy, but the people you elected sure don't. And here we'll focus on the District Attorney of Manhattan and his personal death squad, otherwise known as the New York Police Department. Hey, spying on Muslims all day is hard work, so the police like to relax by shooting their guns in crowded areas. When you hit a few innocent bystanders, then you charge the unarmed man you were shooting at and missed for injuring the innocent bystanders that your bullets hit. But don't take my word for it. This is from the New York Times, lightly edited for clarity by me. The story is titled, Unarmed Man is Charged with Wounding Bystanders Shot by Police near Times Square, by James C. McKinley, dated December 4, 2013. On September 14, police fired their guns at an emotionally disturbed man as he was lurching around traffic near Times Square. The bullets the police fired did not hit him, but wounded two bystanders. Today, it was revealed that the disturbed man, whom the police shot at, has been charged with assault, on the theory that he was responsible for the bullet wounds suffered by the two bystanders. The man, Glenn Broadnax, 35, of Brooklyn, created a disturbance on September 14, wading into traffic at 42nd Street and 8th Avenue and throwing himself into the path of oncoming cars. Police officers arrived and tried to corral Mr. Broadnax. When he reached into his pants pocket, two officers opened fire, missing him but hitting two nearby women. Finally, a police sergeant knocked Mr. Broadnax down with a taser. The shootings once again raised questions about police use of firearms in crowded areas. They drew comparisons to a shooting a year ago, when officers' bullets struck nine bystanders in front of the Empire State Building. Initially, Mr. Broadnax was arrested on misdemeanor charges of menacing, drug possession, and resisting arrest. But the Manhattan District Attorney's Office persuaded a grand jury to charge Mr. Broadnax with assault. This is a felony carrying a maximum sentence of 25 years in jail. Quote, the defendant is the one that created the situation that injured innocent bystanders, unquote, said an assistant district attorney, Shannon Lucy. The names of the two officers who shot the bystanders have not been released. The officers have been placed on administrative duty. To date, no charges have been brought against the two policemen. Here is environmentalist Derek Jensen. He's addressing a 2011 conference titled Earth at Risk. And Jensen is exploring the difficult question, at what point do things get so bad that we have the duty to resist?
The only miracle we're going to get is us. And this conference is really about starting to make that miracle happen. Sophie Scholl of the White Rose Society, who was killed by the Nazis for her resistance, said, somebody, after all, had to make a start. What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just do not dare to express themselves as we did. So Earth at Risk is a conference about fighting back. The dominant culture, civilization, is killing the planet. And it's long past time that those of us who care about life on Earth began to take the actions necessary to stop this culture from destroying every living being. By now, we all know the statistics and trends. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There's 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the oceans. 97% of native forests are destroyed. 98% of native grasslands. Amphibian populations are collapsing. Migratory songbird populations are collapsing. Mollusk populations are collapsing. Fish populations are collapsing, and so on. 200 species are driven extinct each and every day. If we don't know the statistics and trends, we should. And by the way, have you noticed that you don't have to clean your windshield nearly as often as you used to? Even insect populations are collapsing. This culture destroys land bases. That's what it does. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing that comes to mind cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? One of the first written myths of this culture is about Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq to build a great city. The Arabian Peninsula used to be oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. We've all heard of the cedars of Lebanon. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. I'll say it again. This culture destroys land bases. And it won't stop doing so because we ask nicely. We don't live in a democracy. And before you gasp at this blasphemy, ask yourself, do governments better serve corporations or living beings? Do judicial systems hold CEOs accountable for their destructive, often murderous acts? Here's a couple of riddles that aren't very funny. Question: what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? Answer: 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. Question: what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? Answer: retirement with full pay and benefits. That's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, which caused the mass murder at Bhopal. Another way to say this is, what do you call someone who conspires to put poison in the subways of Tokyo? You call them a terrorist and you put them in prison for life. What do you call someone who conspires to put poison in the groundwater of the United States? You call them Dick Cheney. Or oil and gas man, fracker. Do the rich face the same judicial system as you or I? Does life on earth have as much standing in a court as does a corporation? We all know the answers to those questions. We also know that if you allow destructive institutions to continue, they'll destroy your community. And we know in our bones, if not always our heads, that this culture won't undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. I've asked thousands upon thousands of people of all walks of life, from activists to students to people I've met on buses and planes, whether they believe the culture will undergo that voluntary transformation. Almost nobody ever says yes. So if you care about life on the planet, and if you believe the culture won't voluntarily cease to destroy it, how does that belief affect your methods of resistance? Most of us don't know, because most of us don't talk about it. This conference talks about it. This conference is about that shift in strategy and tactics. This conference is about fighting back. We have to put our bodies and our lives between the industrial system and life on the planet. We have to start to fight back. Those who come after, who inherit whatever's left of the world once this culture has been stopped, whether through peak oil, economic collapse, ecological collapse, or the efforts of brave women and men resisting an alliance with the natural world, are going to judge us by the health of the land base, by what we leave behind. They're not going to care how you or I lived our lives. They're not going to care how hard we tried. They're not going to care whether we were nice people. They're not going to care whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care whether we grieved the murder of the planet. They're not going to care whether we were enlightened or not enlightened. They're not going to care what sort of excuses we had to not act. I'm too stressed to think about it. It's too big and scary. I'm too busy. Those in power will kill us if we effectively act against them. If we fight back, we run the risk of becoming like they are. Or, but I recycled. Or any of 1,000 other excuses we've all heard too many times. They're not going to care how simply we lived. They're not going to care how pure we were in thought or action. They're not going to care if we became the change we wish to see. They're not going to care whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green, Libertarian, or not at all. They're not going to care if we wrote really big books. They're not going to care whether we had compassion for the CEOs and politicians running the deathly economy. They're going to care whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. We can fantasize all we want about some great turning, but if the people, including the non-human people, can't breathe, it doesn't matter. Every new study reveals that global warming is happening far more quickly than was previously anticipated. Staid scientists are now suggesting the real possibility of billions of human beings being killed off by what some are calling a climate holocaust. A recently released study suggests an increase in temperature of 16 degrees Celsius, that's 30 degrees Fahrenheit, by the year 2100. We're not talking about this culture killing humans and indeed the planet sometime in the far distant future. This is the future that children born today will see and suffer in their lifetimes. Honestly, is this culture worth more than the lives of your own children? In The Nazi Doctors, Robert J. Lifton explored how it was that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could lend their skills to prisons where inmates were worked to death or killed in assembly lines. He found that many of the doctors honestly cared for their charges and did everything within their power, which meant pathetically little, to make life better for the inmates. If an inmate got sick, they might give the inmate an aspirin to lick. They might put the inmate to bed for a day or two, but not for too long, or the inmate might be selected for murder. If the patient had a contagious disease, they might kill the patient to keep the disease from spreading. All this made sense within the confines of Auschwitz. The doctors, once again, did everything they could to help the inmates, except for the most important thing of all. They never questioned the existence of Auschwitz itself. They never questioned working the inmates to death. They never questioned starving them to death. They never questioned imprisoning them. They never questioned torturing them. They never questioned poisoning them. They never questioned the existence of a culture that would lead to those atrocities. They never questioned the logic that leads inevitably to the electrified fences, the gas chambers, the bullets in the brain. We as environmentalists do the same. We fight as hard as we can to protect the places we love, using the tools of the system the best we can. Yet we don't do the most important thing of all. We don't question the existence of the whole death culture. We don't question the existence of an economic and social system that's working the world to death, that's starving it to death, that's imprisoning it, that's torturing it. We never question the logic that leads inevitably to clear cuts, murdered oceans, loss of topsoil, dammed rivers, poisoned aquifers. And we certainly don't stop these horrors. What do all of the so-called solutions to global warming that are presented in the mainstream, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Without physical reality, without a real world, you don't have any economic system whatsoever. Any solution to global warming, any solution to any of these problems, has to take the real physical world as a given, and the social system as that which must conform to the real world. I mean, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? If you ask any reasonably intelligent 7-year-old, which I've done, so I've asked a 7-year-old, so what will it take to stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? And the 7-year-old said, stop burning oil and gas! I said, you are smarter than any environmentalist I've ever met. If you ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for a green high-tech consulting corporation, you're going to receive an answer that actually helps the corporation more than the real physical world. I mean, that's another way to think about this, is that, you know, what do you do if your bathtub is overflowing? Turn off the tap, right? Well, actually, no. If you're an environmentalist, what you do is you apply for a grant to the Pew Charitable Trust, and they will then, you use the money to buy a solar photovoltaic system that can pump the water off your bathroom floor out through a gray water system, and then you can use it for permaculture. I've just succeeded in insulting everyone in the room. When most people in this culture ask, how can we stop global warming, they aren't really asking what they pretend they're asking. They're asking instead, how can we stop global warming without stopping the burning of oil and gas, without stopping the industrial infrastructure, without stopping the whole omnicidal system? And you can't. It's like people say, how can we save the salmon? It's actually pretty straightforward. Remove dams, stop industrial logging, stop industrial fishing, stop the murder of the oceans, stop global warming. When people say, how can we save salmon, what they're really asking is, how can we save salmon without removing dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the ocean, without stopping global warming? The answer, you can't. Here's another way to look at all this. What would we do if space aliens had invaded this planet and they were vacuuming the oceans and cutting down native forests and putting dams on every river and changing the climate and putting dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens into every mother's breast milk and into the flesh of your children, lover, mother, father, brother, sister, friends, into your own flesh? If space aliens were doing all this, would you resist? If there existed a resistance movement, would you join it? If not, why not? How much worse would the damage have to get before you'd stop those who were killing the planet, killing those you love, killing you? 90% of the large fish in the oceans are already gone. What is your threshold for resistance? 91%? 92? 93? 94? Would you wait till they killed off 95%? 96? 97? 98? 99%? How about 100%? Would you fight back then? I just this last week read that the oceans are already too acidic for oysters to reproduce, for baby oysters to make their shells. By asking these questions, I'm in no way implying that people should not try to work within the system to slow the culture's destructiveness. Right now, a large energy corporation, state and federal governments, local Indian nations, and various interest groups, from environmental organizations to fishermen to farmers, have negotiated their way toward removing 5 dams on the Klamath River within the next 15 years. Whether salmon will survive that long is dubious. That's something. That's important. But there are 2 million dams in the United States alone. 60,000 of those dams are taller than 13 feet. 70,000 of those dams are taller than 6.5 feet. If we only took out one of those 70,000 dams per day, it would take us 200 years. Salmon don't have that time. Sturgeon don't have that time. People sometimes say, oh gosh, Derek, you're so militant, you're so non-compromising, just compromise. Okay, here's a compromise. 5 dams a day, 40 years, done deal. If salmon could take on human manifestation, what would they do? If Delta smelt could take on human manifestation, how long do you think the pumps would last on the Sacramento River? This conference is about fighting back. What do I mean by fighting back? As we explore in this conference, it means first and foremost thinking and feeling for ourselves, finding who and what we love, and figuring out how best to defend our beloved using the means that are appropriate and necessary. This conference starts by acknowledging the dire circumstances that industrial civilization has created for life on this planet. The goal, then, is to deprive the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. It also means defending and rebuilding just and sustainable human communities nestled inside repaired and restored land bases. This is a vast undertaking, but it needs to be said. It can be done. Industrial civilization can be stopped. People routinely approach me to tell me how their hope and despair have merged into one. They no longer want to do everything they can to protect the places they love, everything that is, except the most important thing of all, to bring down the culture itself. They want to go on the offensive. They want to stop this culture in its tracks, but they don't know how. This conference is a step toward creating a culture of resistance, and it's a step toward creating an actual resistance. It's a step toward creating the conditions for salmon to be able to return, for songbirds to be able to return, for amphibians to be able to return. This conference is about fighting back, and this conference is about winning. It is simply true that direct actions against strategic infrastructure is a basic tactic for both militaries and insurgents the world over for the simple reason that it works. But such actions alone are never a sufficient strategy for achieving a just outcome. This means that any strategy aiming for a just future must include a call to build direct democracies based on human and non-human rights and sustainable material cultures, which means that the different branches of resistance movements must work in tandem. The above ground and below ground, the militants and the nonviolent, the frontline activists and the cultural workers. We need it all. And we need courage. The word courage comes from the same root as cœur, the French word for heart. We need all the courage of which the human heart is capable, forged into both weapon and shield to defend what is left of this planet. And the lifeblood of courage is, of course, love. So while this is a conference about fighting back, in the end, this is a conference about love. The songbirds and the salmon need your heart, no matter how weary, because even a broken heart is still made of love. They need your heart because they are disappearing, slipping into that longest night of extinction. And the resistance is nowhere in sight. We'll have to build that resistance from whatever comes to hand. Whispers and prayers, history and dreams, from our bravest words and braver actions. It'll be hard, there'll be a cost, and in too many implacable dawns it will seem impossible. But we'll have to do it anyway. So gather your heart and join with every living being. With love as our first cause, how can we fail? Thank you.
Derek Jensen. On New World Notes, we've moved from Obamacare to criminal justice to the destruction of the planet, ending on a call for both action and love. I'd love to say more, but we are out of time. Thank you for listening. Find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust saying, illegitimae non carborundum, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.